So yeah, last time we looked at virtue and Ritta, and today we're going to move on to ascetic traditions, and we'll look at the Upanishads as well. Now, there's evidence for the development of ascetic traditions for inner purification and the attaining of supernatural powers from an early period, with some suggestion in the Rig Veda and information in the Upanishads and from Buddhist sources as well. But it's impossible, however, to give any accurate dates, and Patrick Olivelle refers to the origin of ascetic traditions to be in the middle of the first millennium BCE. So there's a difficulty in what the origins of these things are. Now, there used to be some debate about whether the origins of asceticism lie in Aryan traditions or in non-Aryan groups. The idea, if you remember from a few weeks ago, that Aryan migrations came into North India and they developed this Vedic religion focused on the sacrifice. And there used to be an argument that asceticism came from outside of that field, came from a different worldview, came from a non-Aryan, possibly Dravidian source. But some scholars, such as Madeleine Biardot, argue that all later ascetic ideas are natural, organic developments from the Vedic tradition, from within the Brahmanical tradition. And there's a problem of isolating at this time of the Aryan from the non-Aryan. How can we possibly do that at this point in time? If we accept the idea of Aryan migrations into North India, which I think there's strong evidence for, if you read Witzel, very quickly I imagine that the Aryan populations will become integrated in with the local populations, and that's even reflected in language. So the retroflex in Sanskrit, the retroflex sound ta ta da da na, is not an Indo-European sound; it's a Dravidian sound. So there's an influence into the language immediately from the Dravidian languages. And so anyway, there's a problem of isolating Aryan elements from non-Aryan. It's probably impossible, particularly by the time of our textual witnesses. Now, there's political and economic development in the Ganges Plain in the first millennium BC. So about 400 BC, you have urbanization occurring. Now, the Vedic religion, as we saw, was what Stephanie Jamieson calls an ideally portable religion, because you don't need any temples or anything. All you need is a post to tie the sacrificial animal to, and some bricks to make the fire altar. But so it's a rural-based religion. Now, as time goes on, you get the towns developing in the Ganges Plain, Patna, other places like that. And you get urbanization, trade developing, and the growth of surplus wealth. And the Buddha comes into this world, this urbanization. And Richard Gombrich makes an interesting point in his book on Theravada Buddhism, that because of this urbanization, you had also the spread of disease at the same time, because people are living on top of each other and they haven't built up enough immunity to these things. And this was one of the sources for the Buddha's emphasis on suffering. It could be. Because everyone had the flu, so the so anyway, there's urbanization, there's trade, there's both a surplus of wealth, and an urban culture developing, and the surplus of wealth arguably was able to support an ascetic population. Now, you do have early ascetic figures, however. There's the Yajamana, who is the patron of the sacrifice, who pays for the sacrifice. And he undergoes tapas. Tapas in the Veda means asceticism or austerity, and its literal meaning is heat. So through austerity, you create heat in the body, tapas, the heat of asceticism. And this was often literally enacted, because the yajamana would sit for purification in a small leaf hut, as it were, like a sweat lodge, which was heated up. So he would perspire, and this heat would purify the body. So you do get ascetic figures in the early Vedic corpus. So the yajamana can be seen as a proto-ascetic figure. Well, he undergoes asceticism for periods of time before the ritual. And there's also a group of ascetics called the Vratyas. Now, it's not really clear who the Vratyas were. Vrata means an observance or a vow, and the Vratyas seem to be wandering ascetics outside of the main Vedic society, who were warriors but were also ascetics. So it's an interesting link there between asceticism and warrior bands. There were probably young men who banded together in a kind of brotherhood, if you like. And they call themselves the Vratyas, the ones who have taken the observance or the vow. And these are proto-ascetics. I have a student who's arguing that the Vratyas, a DPhil student arguing that the Vratyas were a different kind of ascetic, and they're proto-tantric ascetics, which is an interesting argument. So I'll be interesting to see how he develops that. Now, the Keshin hymn, in the Rig Veda, there's a hymn, one hymn to an ascetic called the Keshin, the one with the hair, the long-haired ascetic. And this hymn is interesting because it seems to describe a naked ascetic, a bit like later Hindu ascetics, who is sky-clad, and he flies through the air, it says. Now, this flying through the air could refer to yogic powers that later yogis were said to have achieved. But it's only one hymn, and it could bear witness. Some scholars argue that it bears witness to non-Aryan ascetics. And it's interesting, this hymn, because it mentions a goddess called Kunamamna, I can't remember her name properly, Kunamamna, who is the crooked one. You have to check that out, though. And she is perhaps a precursor of the later Kundalini, who also is also the crooked goddess, as we'll see. So there is some evidence of asceticism in the early Vedic literature. Well, our evidence for asceticism mainly comes from outside the Vedic fold, in the traditions called the Shramana traditions or the Samana traditions. And the Shramanas were wandering ascetics. So the Buddhism and Jainism and the Ajivikas and Lokayatas and other groups were Shramana groups. So the word Samana occurs a lot in the Pali Canon. Wandering ascetics who were seeking liberation from suffering. I think that's an interesting point that Richard Gombrich makes in his book about urbanization and possibly the spread of disease and so on. And the Shramanas seem to have developed within that context. And there is an argument that the origins of asceticism are not in the Vedic tradition, but in the non-Vedic Shramana traditions. And there seems to be these two groups, the Brahmin and the Shramana, were two identifiable religious figures, if you like, in the first millennium BC. And there's one text that talks about an antagonism between the Shramana and the Brahmana, and their relationship was that between like a mongoose and a snake, says this text. So they were different, they represented different worlds. And the Shramanas generally rejected the Vedic revelation and rejected ritualism. So the earliest shamana tradition is Jainism, and here's the Jinnah, a naked ascetic practicing meditation and achieving this state of enlightenment or liberation from suffering through this inner practice of asceticism and meditation. And that's an early, well, it's not an early, it's a modern version, it's a modern representation of the Jinnah, Mahavira, who is about 100 years before the Buddha. And here we have the Buddha practicing asceticism, that famous image from Lahore, which during the Buddha's the Buddha left home to seek enlightenment, and on his journey he met five ascetics who he stayed with, and he practiced severe asceticism, and this is a representation of him practicing severe asceticism. And it says in the Pali Canon that if he touched his stomach, he could feel his backbone, and if he touched his back, he could feel the skin of his stomach. But he decided, he's getting headaches, and he decided that this practice of severe asceticism wasn't very good for him. So he took a bowl of rice. The woman offered him a bowl of rice, which he ate. And the other ascetics left him in disgust, saying that Gautama has taken to a life of abundance. But having eaten the bowl of rice, he achieved enlightenment. But this is a very striking figure of the Buddha practicing asceticism. Although generally the Buddhists are anti-ascetic. Could you open the... I don't know how to keep that door open. Hello, Jai. Welcome. We haven't been going for too long. We're talking about asceticism. And here is the fasting Buddha. And he started to practice the middle way after that, although he did allow the dutangas, the extreme ascetic practices for the monks, such as just wearing one robe, only eating once a day, living in cremation grounds. So you've got the shamana traditions, which are clearly ascetical, and you've got interesting ideas coming from the shamana traditions, such as liberation from the cycle of suffering. But you also have Brahmanical traditions of asceticism, which seem to be developing within the constraints of Vedic revelation. And some of the key ideas of these ascetic traditions seem to be anti-ritualism. Now, I put a question mark beside that, because the shamana traditions are themselves ritualistic in many ways, but just a different kind of ritual. So they tended to be against the sacrifice, against ritual sacrifice. And with the Upanishads, we get this idea that the sacrifice has to be internalized. The true sacrifice is the sacrifice of the breath to the higher self, if you like. So you get this idea of the internalization of the sacrifice in the Upanishads. And this is accompanied by the idea of samsara. Samsara is the cycle of reincarnation over and over again. The soul is reborn over and over again. So as it says in the Kathara Upanishad, as a caterpillar or a leech gets to the end of a blade of grass and the grass bends over and then it goes on to another blade of grass, so the soul goes from body to body. So there's a whole complex of ideas begins to develop with the ascetic tradition. Samsara, that we're born over and over again in a state of suffering. And there's liberation, moksha, from that. Moksha, or the Buddhist word nirvana. But nirvana is also used in the Bhagavad Gita. So moksha, from the root much, to free or liberate. So the ideals of the ascetics are liberation from the cycle of rebirth. And how do you do that? So you get freedom from samsara, freedom to this state of liberation or moksha, and freedom by... You get this through the practice of yoga and meditation and inner practices. And also, there's a great emphasis on non-harm, ahimsa. So Vedic sacrifice, because it harmed animals, was wrong in the Shramana eyes and in the ascetic's eyes. And they develop these ideas of yoga and meditation. Now the debate is whether these ideas of yoga, meditation, samsara, moksha came from within the Vedic tradition as an organic development or from outside of it. Arguably, because of the presence of the Shramana traditions outside of the Vedic fold, these ideas arguably developed there mainly, but also latched on to dimensions within the Vedic tradition itself, which were articulated particularly in the ashrama system that Patrick Oliver has written about. The idea that there are stages of life that you follow. The student stage, the householder stage, the hermit stage, and then finally the renouncer stage. So asceticism is incorporated into the path of your life. So you practice asceticism as a student, as a celibate student, as a householder you perform the obligations of social duty, responsibility, pleasure and prosperity or wealth, and then you give those up to seek liberation in the third and fourth stage of life, in which you practice asceticism. And these ascetics, the ascetic traditions, were concerned with philosophical questions. So who am I? What's the meaning of life, and so on? What's the purpose? How can I escape from suffering? So those are the questions that the ascetic traditions were concerned with. And they came up with answers to them. And there's the famous story of the Buddha, when an ascetic, he was often disputing with different ascetics, and some of the questions, the avyakta questions, the unanswered questions, like what is the nature of a Buddha, of a Tathagata, and what happens in nirvana, what happens in enlightenment, do you disappear or not? He says these are questions, purely intellectual questions, which have no relevance, which have no real meaning. Like a man with an arrow in him asking who fired the arrow and what the family of the man who fired the arrow is, and so on. What you have to do is get rid of the arrow, pull the arrow out, is the main task. And so these philosophical questions, although they were interesting and they were discussed, the main focus of these ascetic traditions seemed to be on practice and the idea of going beyond suffering. But nevertheless, philosophical questions remained. And Dumont argues that the main sort of intellectual powerhouse of the Hindu traditions is in the ascetic traditions, in the renouncer traditions. Because it was the renouncers who produced all the systems of philosophy. Now, one of the key questions of the renouncer traditions and Brahmanical traditions generally was the nature of action. So what gets you liberated? Action, the performance of sacrifice, or the renunciation of action, giving up action, as the Shramana traditions claimed. So in Jainism, if you act, that creates karma, and that keeps you trapped in the world. And karma is a substance, a material substance that covers the soul. So you have to clean the soul through ascetic practices, get rid of the karma from the soul. And then your soul will float to the top of the universe where it will be liberated. So you want to not act. So the ultimate goal of the Jain ascetic is non-action. Now it's interesting that the Jains became an incredibly successful community, and still are today. They became a very wealthy community. One of the reasons was the emphasis on non-violence, ahimsa, a great emphasis on non-violence, which meant that they didn't farm, because farming involves ploughing, which involves killing creatures. So on the one hand, you've got a highly successful material community. On the other hand, you've got a very strong ascetical tradition with naked ascetics, the Digambras, and the white-clad ascetics, who practice extreme non-violence. the idea is that action keeps you trapped in the world, so you have to stop acting. And eventually you get a ritual suicide in Jain traditions, where the ascetic starves himself to death over a period of time so that they completely withdraw from the world and don't act. Now, the Hindu reaction to that was, it's not so much action which is a problem, but attachment to action. So in the Bhagavad Gita, as we'll see, you get the idea of the renunciation of the fruits of action rather than the renunciation of action itself. And in the Upanishads, we have the idea that true renunciation is internal. Now, the Upanishads are texts which began to be composed about 800 BC. I'll say a few words about the Upanishads before going on to the Bhagavad Gita solution. And they were commentaries, if you like, on the Vedas, on the Vedic scriptures. So each of the lineages of the Vedas, like the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, the Yajur, and so on, has Brahmanas associated with it and also Upanishads. So the first technical Upanishad is the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is calls itself an Aranyaka. Now, the Aranyakas were the third stage, if you like, the third phase in the development of this literature. If you remember, you have the Samhitas and the Brahmanas and the Aranyakas. Aranyaka means forest texts, forest treatises. And then the Upanishads. And this constitutes the corpus of all of Vedic literature. And then you get these streams, if you like, the Rig Veda, the Sama, and so on. And each of these branches has its own Brahmana, so the Rig Veda Brahmana, and an Aranyaka, and an Upanishad associated with it. So the earliest Upanishad, the Brihad, the great forest or wilderness of Panisha, Aranyaka, the great Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. And these are composed from about 800 BCE. Right the way through to the medieval period, really, but the classical standard Upanishads are the famous ones, like the Brihadaranyaka, the Chaldogya, the Katha, and so on, 13 principal Upanishads. And these texts tend to have a philosophical commentary on the earlier tradition. So Upanishad comes to mean secret doctrine, rahasya, which is secret teaching. And it's from it means sitting at the feet of the master. So shad is sit, ni is down, sitting at the feet of the Upanishad. So it's the idea that there are secret teachings that you get through sitting at the feet of the master. We're just talking about the Upanishads at the moment. And what are these secret teachings? The secret teachings of the Upanishads are karma, for one thing. That what you do has effects. And that liberation is the freedom from karma. It's freedom from this power that causes the soul to be reincarnated over and over again. Now, karma means action. It originally meant ritual action, but it has an extended meaning to mean significant action. So, you give up karma means originally you give up ritual. And you get the idea of liberation, and you get the idea that the soul, the Atman, in the earlier Upanishads, is identical with the power of the universe, which is the Brahman. If you remember, the term Brahman in the Vedas meant the power of the sacrifice. It's the energy of the sacrifice which makes it efficacious. And in the Upanishads, this becomes the power of the universe. And that your essence, your very essence, is identical with that. So the basic teachings of the earlier Upanishads are that the essence of the self is identical with the essence of the universe. The Atman and the Brahman are coterminous. So in the Chandogya Upanishad, you get the famous saying, like Tat Tvam Asi, you are that. You are that power, you are that essence. So the dialogue between Shveta Ketchum and his father, his father tells him to go and get a glass of water, put salt in it, and drink it. And Shveta Ketchum can't tell the difference between, as salt pervades the water, so this Brahman pervades the universe. And you are that, Shveta Ketchum, Tadvamasi. Now, later traditions, you get a more theistic element coming into the later Upanishads, particularly the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, which is akin to the Bhagavad Gita in many ways. Which we'll be looking at in a minute, Shvetashvatara. The White Mule Upanishad. So the Upanishads were composed in the middle of India. They didn't seem to be aware of the Shramana traditions very much, but they could well have been influenced by them. And the Buddha was probably aware of some of the teachings of the Upanishads when he taught the doctrine of no self, anatta. So the Upanishads are esoteric interpretations of the earlier sacrificial religion. And they claim that true renunciation is internal, is the sacrifice of the breath to the self. It's not the killing of animals. It's becoming, and it's developing tapas, heat, inner heat of asceticism. And so through the renunciation of action, you achieve liberation, moksha, which is the realization, the knowledge, the jnana, that the self is identical with the absolute. So from karma, if you like, from action, ritual action, there comes to be an emphasis on knowledge, jnana. It's not what you do that counts, but what you understand. Your jnana, which is the difference, particularly from, say, Jainism, where we have the idea that karma is a substance which covers the soul, and so you have to get rid of the substance through action, through ascetic action, cleans the soul. And then once it's clean, the soul can float up to the top of the universe and be liberated. And that idea also comes into later Shaiva traditions as well, the soul of karma as a material substance. But in the Upanishads, it doesn't seem to be a material substance. And there's a great emphasis on the jnana, on knowledge. So spiritual higher knowledge. Now the Bhagavad Gita comes along and has a solution to the dilemma of action or renunciation of action. It says, you can have both. You can act in the world, do your duty, while at the same time renouncing action. But you don't not act, like in Jainism, but you give up the fruits of action. You renounce the fruits of action. You become detached from action. So you can perform your duty as a warrior, in Arjuna's case, but while being detached and giving up the fruits of action to Krishna, to God. So it's an attempted solution to the dilemma. you can be an actor and also an ascetic at the same time. Now, in the Shramana and in the ascetic traditions, there was a great concern about the nature of the self, philosophical concern about the self, and we see this in the Upanishads. And this is one of the Gita's solution to the problem. Karmani akarmaya pasyed akarmani chakarmaya sabudima manusheshu sayukta prisna karma krit. So he who perceives action, pasyed, who should see action in non-action, akarma, is wise. He who perceives non-action in action and action in non-action is wise among men. And he performs action in a controlled way. Yukta. He's yukta, controlled. Yukta. He controls all action in a controlled way. So you Sanskrit is, that's a third person, a sheet, third person singular. Optative, he should. Yahu, who, nominative singular, who should see karma in, locative, in, sorry, akarma, who should see non-action in action, karmani, locative. And cha, action in non-action, akarmi. Sa, he is Buddha, he is possessing buddhi, he is wise, possessing wisdom. Manusheshu, locative plural, among people, among men. He, sa, is yukta, he's controlled. And he is the crit, he is the doer of all action. So he performs action in a controlled way. So this idea of becoming controlled is important. Yukta is from the verbal root yuj, from which we get yoga. So it's a verbal form of yoga, yukta. And it's also cognate with the English word yoke, to yoke something or control something. So yukta is controlled, yoked, like two oxen are yoked. Discipline. So you become controlled. You become the senses which are going out into the world all the time are constrained, are pulled in, and become controlled in order to achieve liberation. Now you get different interpretations of this. Shankara comes along, as we'll see, and says that action is falsely attributed to the self, because the self is in truth, in its essence, is non-acting. And the sage who is liberated in life, who is Jivan Mukta, is free from attachment. And action only keeps the body going, and the action is for others. But in your true self, you do not act, according to Shankara. Because, according to Shankara, both activity and inactivity require an agent, and agency is illusory in Shankara's doctrine. We'll look at this more in more detail in a week or so. Now, this doctrine of non-action, of detached action, is exemplified even in the modern world. So here we have a Ramana Maharshi, who was an Advaita saint. I just thought I'd chuck it through in a picture of Ramana Maharshi. Anyone heard of Ramana Maharshi? Yeah, he meditated. Who am I? Was his mantra, I suppose. Maybe, who am I? And he was said to be an enlightened saint in this tradition. Now, Ramanuja writes also a commentary on the Gita.
Sorry, Gavin. I was just going to say that Ramana in his Uptesara, is written in a text called Uptesara, says that karma itself is inert.
Ah.
And that inertness, I think, is related to what Shankara had commented on in the Bhagavad Gita, that really the sense of karma, the action, the agency of action, is all illusory.
Yes.
So I think he was talking about that in terms of karma itself being inert, and so how can it make any difference to anybody?
Mm.
Through action, you cannot achieve liberation.
That's right, very much so, yeah, yeah. So yes, he was very much in that tradition. So jnana, cognition or understanding, knowledge, spiritual knowledge, is what gives you liberation, not action. Because the action is jada, is inert, as you say, is unconscious. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, very much in the Shankara tradition. Now Ramanuja, he writes a comment disagreeing with some of that. He talks about the need to develop interiority. And true renunciation along the lines of the Gita, being giving up the results of action, being detached from action. But we'll look at Shankara and Ramanuja in coming weeks. Now, one of the practices of these ascetic traditions, one of the central key ideas is yoga. Now, yoga appears in the Upanishads. In the Katha Upanishad, you get the idea of yoga. And particularly in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the last of the great Upanishads, probably composed about 1st or 2nd century BC. Now, Shvetashvatara was the name of a sage. And this is the last Upanishad. It's well worth looking at. Shvetra is white, Ashvatara, Ashvara is a horse, and Ashvatara is a thing like a horse. It's the white sage Upanishad. And it begins with the fundamental questions of life. A bit like Heidegger's question, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there this life? Why is there this universe? And all these big questions of life. And then it goes on to develop this idea of yoga, that you achieve knowledge, liberating cognition through the practice of yoga. And what is yoga? Yoga is, in this text, sitting with the back straight, doing various breathing exercises, controlling the body, and then controlling the mind. So there's a link between the body and consciousness. Body, breath, and mind are linked up together. So if you control the body and you control the breath, then you can control the mind.
What did you say was the date?
Probably about the 1st or 2nd century BC. It's a later date. There's a German scholar called Oberlies who redated it not too long ago to that later date. It's probably contemporary with the Bhagavad Gita. I often think of the Shvetashvatara as the Shaiva Bhagavad Gita, really. Although, because in that text, Rudra comes to the fore. Now, yoga is cuts across all Hindu traditions, really, and these ascetic traditions particularly emphasize yoga. And it's the idea that consciousness can be changed or transformed by focusing attention on a single point. Ekagrata. So agra, like the name of the place, agra, agrata, pointedness, and then eka is one. So ekagrata is one pointedness, focusing on a single point. And yoga is a discipline, or a range of disciplines, constructed to facilitate the transformation of consciousness. That's arguably a definition of yoga. Now, what is consciousness? Chitta. Chitta is the word used, one of the words, is being aware, and chitta determines the world being experienced. This is a fundamental doctrine of these traditions. So there's the loka, which is the world, and there's the chitta, which is the consciousness. And then the quality or nature of the chitta determines the loka, determines the one experience. So as is the chitta, so is the loka. Now, at one level, it's, if you're in a bad mood, then the world's a terrible place. If you're happy, the world's a great place. But it's more radical than that. It says that there are different levels in the universe, if you like. There's the material world that we inhabit here because of the state of our chitta. But if you change your chitta, you will experience different lokas, different worlds of experience, higher worlds, non-material worlds. And these were in states of concentration called samadhi, the yogi was thought to experience these higher worlds and these other worlds. Now, in early Buddhism, this is systematized into the system of jhanas or dhyanas, the rupa jhana and the arupa jhana, and so on. In fact, a lot of the source is probably from Buddhism, of these traditions. So in the Buddhist cosmology, there's a slight distraction, but you get the karma loka, the world of desire, which is this world. Above that, you get the world of form, the rupa loka. And above that, you get the non-form, formless worlds, arupa loka. Now, this hierarchical cosmology came to influence Hindu traditions as well. So through meditation, through the practice of yoga, you get into these higher states of consciousness called jhana. And these became the rupa jhana and the arupa jhana. Jhana is the Pali for the Sanskrit dhyana. So the yogi will practice these levels of meditation, and the Buddha is said to have got enlightened from the fourth jhana, not from the karma loka. And then there are these, the realm of infinite consciousness, infinite space, and the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, whatever that means. And then from this fourth level, from the fourth jhana, you can experience, you can cultivate magical powers.
What's the fourth one? Sorry. You've got Arupa.
Oh, sorry, this is a Buddhist. Yeah, you probably don't have to worry about it, but these are just four levels of the Rupa jhanas and four levels of the Arupa jhanas.
Sorry.
Which are refinements of the fourth jhana.
Yeah.
Now, that Buddhist structure seems to have come into the Hindu traditions, seems to have entered into the yoga traditions. And here, each of these is filled out with different qualities, mental qualities. Like vitaka is throwing the mind onto an object. So you think of a green apple, that's throwing the mind onto an object. Vitarka is keeping the mind on that green object, which is terribly difficult because it keeps going out away. So throwing the mind onto the object and keeping it there. And that allows one-pointedness to develop. Ekagrata. And once ekagrata develops, that develops joyfulness, piti, and happiness, sukha. And that all of those are called jhana factors in the first jhana, and then they get refined and so on. Now, all of that enters into the yoga tradition. So consciousness in is being aware, and you change your chitta and you change your loka. And also the idea is that consciousness takes on the qualities of its objects. So the quality of your mind is determined by what you contemplate, by what your focus of attention is. So if your focus of attention is going down the pub every day or something, that's the quality of your consciousness will reflect that. Or if you focus on a god or a mantra, that's supposed to purify your consciousness, to raise your consciousness to that level, if you like. So that's a Greek idea as well, that the mind takes on the qualities of its objects. Now, Patanjali, in the 1st to 2nd or 3rd centuries BC, again, it's very difficult to date these texts, developed these ideas systematically in the famous book, the Yoga Sutras. And these are the first four Yoga Sutras, which contain arguably the essence of the teachings about yoga. Yoga Anushasanam, Atta Yoga Anushasanam. Now the teaching about yoga. Now, this is the classic definition of yoga. What is yoga? Yoga is the cessation of mental fluctuations. So the question, what is yoga? Yoga is, from the Sanskrit, it's yogash chitta-vritti nirodaha. So nominative singular, and the visarga will become a sha. Yogaha chitta-vritti. Chitta-vritti, vritti is going round, turning round, of chitta, the turning around of chitta, the fluctuations of chitta. And nirodaha, so chitta-vritti, the fluctuations of chitta, and nirodaha is the stopping, the cessation of the fluctuations of consciousness. So stilling the mind, keeping the mind still. And once this mind is still, then, tada, then the seer, the self, the drashtri, the one who sees, abides in its own nature, in its svarupa, in its every essence, abides in its own self. So tada drashtu, of genitive singular, of the seer, the in svarupa locative, avasthanam, the condition, then the seer abides in its own nature. In the svarupa, in the essence or the own form of the seer, of the one who sees, tada, then there is the avasthanam, the abiding in the true nature of the seer. If there is that, if there's cessation of mental fluctuations, then there's abiding in the true nature of the witness of the seer. Otherwise, nitaratra, there is conformity to the fluctuations, vritti sarupya. Sarupya, conformity to the vrittis. And we remain trapped in the cycle of rebirth. Now the aim of this then is liberation. Now in the yoga traditions you get different understandings of liberation, but in yoga it's kaivalya. Sorry, in the Hindu tradition different understandings of liberation, but in the yoga tradition it's kaivalya. Kaivalya means isolation. Aloneness. And it's the isolation of the soul from matter. So behind the yoga tradition, the metaphysics, which we'll be looking at more closely in coming weeks, is a tradition called Samkhya, which is a dualist tradition, which says there are two things in the universe. There's the soul and matter or prakriti, and there's purusha, the spirit. And the goal of life is to separate the soul from matter, because this entangled in matter gets reborn over and over again. Now, although this is an orthodox Vedic form of philosophy, there is an argument that actually its origins are non-Vedic. It could be, because it's very linked to the Shramana traditions. So on the one hand you've got a metaphysical dualist system, and on the other hand you've got the Upanishadic lowest non-dual system. You've got these two kind of metaphysical ideas within the ascetic traditions. The non-dualism of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka, the Chandogya, Tattvamasi, you are that, Shveta Ketam, and so on. And that's contrasted with his very early tradition of Samkhya, which says actually the soul is entangled in matter, and the goal of life is to free the soul from matter. And this is the metaphysical backdrop behind yoga. But yoga also penetrates into the Upanishadic worldview as well. So yoga is common to both. But the actual yoga sutras are within this dualist tradition, metaphysical dualism. So the backdrop of Patanjali is Samkhya. Whereas Samkhya is an atheistic system, as we'll see, the yoga is a theistic system, so you have three realities: the Lord, Ishvara, matter, and spirit, Purusha. But the spirit, the soul, the Purusha, is just is equal to Ishvara, is equal to the Lord.
Matter is Prakriti? No, sorry.
Yeah, matter is Prakriti. Now, the Upanishads take this idea, okay, matter is Prakriti, but that's actually it's an emanation of the one power, the one Brahman. So in the Upanishads, the early Upanishads, you have an emphasis on the one, Brahman, which is the all, with which the universe is identical, ultimately. But in the Samkhya, you've got the idea that Prakriti is different from spirit, from Purusha. They use the same words, but they have different understandings. So the Samkhya sees Prakriti, nature, as real and distinct from the spirit. The Upanishads see Prakriti as part of Brahman, as part of this, as the one, if you like, as an emanation of the one. And liberation is merging of the self with the absolute. For the Samkhya tradition and for the Yoga tradition, liberation is the isolation of the soul from matter, Kaivalya.
So, Gavin, what is the relationship to what you just said about Samkhya Yoga and the verse number 2 and 3 in the sense of mental fluctuation? Is that part of Prakriti? Because it would have been part of Prakriti.
Yes, that's right.
And the Prakriti is then being separated through this system of yoga or concentration, so that the seer, who is the Purusha, then separates out from the Prakriti.
That's it. That's exactly it. Yes. Yes. The seer, the Drashtu, who is the Purusha, separates out from Prakriti through stopping the mental fluctuations. Yeah. So we're trapped by our minds going out into the world all the time through the senses, and through stilling the mind, that creates detachment and allows the soul to be free, the Purusha to be free. So this is the Samkhya model is behind the Yoga Sutras. And that's, the Yoga Sutras are also strongly influenced by Buddhism. So I've got time now to develop this, but those terms of, like Samadhi is in the Yoga Sutras, you get this idea of Samadhi. Once you stop the mind, you enter into Samadhi, these higher states of consciousness in which you become absorbed. And Patanjali divides these up into various classes, Savikalpa, Nirvikalpa. I'll see if I can do a chart. When we look at Indian philosophy, we'll carry on with this next week, I think. This is quite interesting. So by way of summary then, there is some debate whether ascetic traditions developed within the Vedic world or from outside of it. There is evidence from the Shramana traditions that asceticism and ideas of yoga and samsara and liberation were originally non-Vedic, although some scholars like Madeleine Biado argues that they're organic developments from within the Vedic tradition. And there's probably truth in both of these. And then today we've surveyed the notion of asceticism and yoga, and we've looked at the Upanishadic idea of union, of oneness, and that you achieve liberation through knowledge. And then we've looked at the ascetic idea that you get rid of you achieve liberation through the renunciation of action, through giving up of action. Now in the Shramana tradition, in the Jain case, it's giving up of action, stop acting. And in the Hindu tradition, it's giving up the fruits of action, particularly in the Bhagavad Gita. And then you get these two main metaphysical traditions behind asceticism. One is the Upanishadic monism, non-dualism, as in the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya Upanishad, which says that the soul, the Atman, is identical with the Absolute. In contrast to the Samkhya system, the metaphysics behind the Yoga Sutras, which says the soul is distinct and has to become isolated from matter in order to achieve liberation. and we'll carry on with this this account next week. Thanks, everyone.